the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world from wherever the beautiful game is played. This is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
So we're here, ladies and gentlemen, here on Beyond the Pitch. I'm Juan Arango again. Glad to have you on board for another episode. And I've been looking forward to this one. This one's quite the interesting episode because it has a very, if you're familiar with the brand Dos Equis, you know, probably the most interesting man in the world. I think if there's a replacement, this guy would probably be it. None other than Coach Steven Constantine over in India. He's the coach of the Indian national team. And it's not just who he's coaching right now, but it's his path, his career coaching that has been so captivating to me. He just recently wrote a book, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit. Steven, hi, how are you, first of all? And second of all, where are you? Because it seems like I'm confused as to where in the world you are at times.
At this moment, I am in the sunny Brighton in England, down on the coast, south coast.
That's not a bad place to be quite honest with you. I mean, Brighton, especially in the summer.
It's not California, but it's okay.
Well, hey, you know what? You could be in London right now, and there's no AC in most of the places that you can live in London. So I guess, yeah, Brighton's a much better place to be. First of all, of course, you're taking a break right now, but tell me a little bit about what's going on right now in Indian football. It seems like there's 2.5 steps forward and maybe 1.75 that they take backward. Tell me a little bit about what's going on, the processes that you've been able to build, but then some of the obstacles that you've had to overcome and look to really smash as far as preconceptions about football in India.
Right. Well, the first misconception is that they don't play football in India. That is absolutely not the case. There are more kids playing football in India than we can count at the moment. The last 3 years has had a tremendous impact on Indians in India. The Indian Super League, which will go into its fourth year in November, has had a great impact on awareness, on bringing quality players to the Indian League. Anelka, Elano, Silvestre, I think Robbie Keane has just joined Calcutta. So the big names now are starting to look at Indian football as, I think in a way as they looked in the MLS about 30 years ago, when they started with the Bobby Moores and the Pelés and this kind of thing. So this is what's happening. It's a bit of a football or soccer revolution that is happening in India. The fans are really getting behind football. And the national team, 3 years ago, we were ranked 174. Today we are 96. And so it's been fantastic for the Indian national team, because obviously the national team is the reflection of your league, things are looking quite good, but obviously it's not been easy, and we still have a long way to go before we can say that the Indian Super League is the place to be. But the biggest obstacle is to understand that you have a problem that has been recognized, and now with the Indian Super League, and don't forget the I League, which is running concurrently this year. Those two leagues will merge next year, and hopefully we'll have one solid 7-8 month long calendar next year.
Problem's been solved, and that's of course very commendable of what India's been able to see and recognize as far as the issues concerned. Now, how you see it, how you're beginning to analyze now with the problem of the league and the merging of the two leagues eventually, what is the biggest problem with Indian football right now?
Okay, there are a couple.
It sounds long and extended when you have to take that breath. Well, yeah. Okay, here we go.
How long do we have? But no, look, for me, the biggest issue obviously has been six foreigners and five Indians. This year, that will change. It will be five foreigners and six Indians. And the year after, it will be four foreigners. And it has to be like that. You need the local players to get the opportunities to develop. And obviously, that will then increase the pool for the national team, make things more competitive. And obviously, you need the local players to be playing. You need people to recognize local talent, support the local talent. So the local clubs having local players, this is all part of the process. And that's one of the problems that is en route to being solved. The other thing is that we start way too late in developing and coaching the players in India. They're 11, they're 12, they're 13. Some of them don't get to see a decent coach until they're 16, 17. And that's, if you look at our under 17 World Cup team, they will have not had a coach until they were 13, maybe, or 12, if they're lucky. Whereas in most of the other countries competing, they would have had coaches from the age of 5 and 6. And that's, you know, 7, 8 years disadvantage and lack of the basic understanding of football, and this is the serious problem.
It's interesting you mention that, because it sounds like a lot of the problems that and I've had Mark Bosnich on the show as well, and a couple other people from the United States, and it's very similar to the problems that are being experienced in those two countries. And I mean, what do you do if you're a coach of the national team? I mean, because your job ultimately is not to develop players, it's to be able to fine tune them for high level performance.
Yeah, but there are countries in the world who national teams in the world who are developing players for the clubs instead of the clubs developing them for the national team. We are one of those countries. Unfortunately, the clubs are not doing anywhere near enough in terms of developing players. So we will have an under 17 camp or trials for the national team. Players will come and take the players from the under 17 national team and put them in their club teams. Instead of us having scouting camps, say, in Mumbai, and we go and see the various clubs in Mumbai to look at the young players, we don't have that opportunity. It's changing, but nowhere near as much as it should be. Mm-hmm. The other problem that I think you have in the US is that you have under 11, under 10, under 9 leagues. And the coaches are interested in winning that league. And trust me, I personally am not interested if you win an under 10 or an under 11 league. If I'm the parent, I want my son to play and my son to develop. And if my son's good enough, then he may have a chance as a professional soccer player. But in the States, it's all about winning the leagues and paying the money, and parents sending their kids to academies that have a winning record, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Really, personally, as a head coach in all the countries, if I know that my coaches are playing to win at under 9, under 10, under 11, I don't want them, because they're not thinking about the development of the player.
I like that comment. I like that, and I definitely agree with that. Is that something you have to deal with as far as educating the parent? And not putting so much emphasis and not putting so much of a, as well as a mental onus on these young kids that are 9, 10 years old, whose priority is to win at all costs. And it can be just, you know, just setting the ball deep and, okay, fine, we won 1-0. That's all that matters. You know, is it more of a matter of going and educating the parents and telling them, hey, what we need to do at this level is this?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head, but I'll tell you something else. It's employing the coaches to do that. Yeah. Because inevitably, it's the coach who's going to set out the tactics. He may have pressure from the parents, but if you can't deal with pressure from the parents, then personally, I don't need him. He needs to be thinking, how many players in this under 10 group or under 12 group can I get to be good enough to go to the next level, the under 13 or under 14. Your best coaches in any club are the coaches who develop the young players. Mm-hmm. The problem is that a lot of these coaches think that by winning that they are producing a winning team, and therefore they are more likely to get moved up in the ranks or to get to a higher level, get a bit more money. So there's a whole concept of how they are being seen, these youth coaches. To me, I had one coach at a club a few years ago. He was absolutely fantastic up to the age of under 14, under 15. He wanted to go up, and I said, look, with me, you're going nowhere. After you finish the under 15s, you're going back to the under 8s because the kids love you. You make the kids fall in love with the game, and because you do that, there's no price on that. I will pay you what you need, what you want because of that, but you're not going higher than that. And he stayed. He realized that this was his niche in football. We've got to develop the kids. The kids have got to fall in love with the game. Once they're hooked, it's done. They'll be playing football for the rest of their lives. Whether they're good enough to go up the ladder, that's another story. But at the younger age groups, I want them to enjoy the game. I want them to be technically sound when they get to the time where it's now under 15, where it starts to become, am I good enough to be a pro, or am I good enough to start the ladder, if you like. Mm-hmm. But it's a process that incorporates the parents, because the parents won't come and bring their kid if you are an academy that's losing in the US, because they think that winning is how their son is going to progress. And that really is not the case.
Are you sure you don't want to come over here to the United States? Because, I mean, what you are saying sometimes makes a little too much sense. I mean, that's what kind of intrigued me about you and your style of organizing things. I mean, have you ever thought about coming back to the United States? The reason why I say is because obviously you played here in this country back about 25 plus years ago or so. I mean, would you ever consider that? I mean, especially with your ideas, because they seem a little bit different compared to what you do here from many coaches that have been at the youth levels for a significant amount of time.
Look, I am somebody who will go anywhere if it's a right opportunity for me. I love the US. I've been back many times. As you probably know, I'm an Oakland Raider fan.
That's what I liked about you.
Yeah, baby. But look, would I come if the opportunity was there? Yes, absolutely. Look, the main thing for me with youth football, and I've played 16 and 17 year olds in internationals and finals in international tournaments. If they're good enough, they're old enough. But in order for that to happen, there needs to be a progress from 5 or 6 years old, where they're thinking about the ball, not kicking the ball, but manipulating the ball. I think if you must have had my friend Tom Beyer on this show a few times.
He's tremendous. I love Tom Beyer.
He is unbelievable. And if only people would listen a bit more, I'm telling you, the football world will be a better place. What is the point of winning an under 10 tournament when none of those players actually go on to have a career in football? Okay, for the coach and for the player. What does the parent want? I want okay, I'll give you an example. I took my daughter to go and play soccer. We spent the 150 euros, whatever it is, to get the ball, to get the shirt, the socks, and blah, blah, blah. And I took her the first day, I took her to the place, and I stayed for 5 minutes and I left. And I'll tell you why I left in a minute. Mm-hmm. So after about a month, she's standing outside my office that we have at home, and she says, Dad, I need to speak to you. And I said, okay, what have you done?
How old was she back then? I'm sorry, how old?
She was about 9.
Okay.
She said, I need to speak to you. I said, okay, is it bad? She goes, I don't think you're going to be happy. I said, well, let's get it out the way and see what happens. She said, Dad, I don't want to go football. What? You've just started. You've only been going 6 weeks. Why don't you want to go? She said, Dad, I'm not learning anything. Now, this is from a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't stay to watch the guy who was coaching her was because he wasn't doing what I would expect them to do at that age. So in order for me not to say anything and make him look bad and embarrass my daughter, I left. But she came on her own, which took a lot of courage, if you ask me. So what I'm trying to say to you is that we need to make it fun. Yes, winning a game is fun. I get that. But there's more to it than that. It shouldn't be about winning and losing at that age group. It should be about developing, enjoying, and having fun. There's plenty of time for it to get serious.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. I totally agree with that concept, because there's many times that you have young players that are very talented, maybe not on the best teams, that they get, I guess, they get catty cornered. They get compartmentalized into this category where, well, they're not good enough because they don't play on X or Y team.
How can you not be good enough at 12 years old?
Exactly.
How in God's name can you say this kid is no good at 12, 11, or 10 years old? You must be some kind of genius to do that. And if you were a genius to do that, you wouldn't be doing what you were doing. Okay. There's so many examples. Ian Wright, for example, didn't get a professional contract till he was 21. Kids learn in different times. Late developers, late bloomers, call it what you want, but not every kid learns the same way in the same fan. The big kid in the school is not generally the big kid by the time they reach the high school.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, at that age group, I'm going to tell a 10-year-old, you can't play, you're no good. And I want to put the other kid because he's skinny and fast. Yeah, it doesn't work like that. Not for me anyway.
Yeah, and you know what? You hit on another point, Steve. I'm here with Stephen Constantine, of course, the national team coach of India on Beyond the Pitch. And it's a great point that you make there, because a lot of the metrics that are used, especially here in the United States, are, well, how fast can he run? How tall is he? How much can he jump? But it really doesn't translate into football, where there's certain intangibles that you have to keep in mind. How good control, you know, his vision, whether he looks up, certain mannerisms that a player has that aren't really looked into in those types of metrics.
Absolutely. And look, you can go to that draft in the NFL. I have a question. You time a player who does the 40-yard dash, but he's not wearing a helmet or pads. So how do you translate that speed into speed in a game with helmets, pads, and somebody trying to kill him?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, absolutely. So in soccer, you can give a 10-year-old an agility test, fine, but at 11, is he the same? Yeah. Or at 10 and a half, is he the same? You know, so it's not about that. I think people should be looking at his technical skills. Is he proficient with his left and his right? Can he control the ball? Does he see the awareness? Does he know what's around him? These little things that you can look for that are not generally in any list.
Yeah, I mean, I see that a lot. And again, that's why it makes so much sense to have, you know, guys like you on the show. I mean, obviously Tom Byers been on here quite often, and it's good to be able to bring these things out. But you mentioned something earlier, your experience. I mean, how important is that as a coach? Obviously, you know, having been in various countries and various cultures, what's the main thing that you've been able to pick up from these different cultures about how they develop football? I mean, what's been the best experience? What's been the worst experience? And I'm talking right now from a football development standpoint.
Look, I think the worst experience is when you go into a national association or you go to a country and they're hell-bent on winning the under-10s or under-11 or under-12 leagues. Because at the end of the day, you are never, ever going to produce a world star, okay? Because you are missing hundreds and thousands of players who have slipped through the cracks, who were not big enough, not fast enough, not strong enough, and you've put them to the side. So they've inevitably turned to other sports, which there are plenty of other sports to do if you're not happy. But I have football, but okay, I'm not quick enough, so I'll go and play something else. So this is something that I think really frustrates me. We have the best game in the world. Every single country in the world is playing football at some level or other. And the reason it is because it doesn't matter how big or how small or how quick or how slow you are. It takes all the attributes that you have, and maybe that gets you a pro career, maybe that gets you into college, but either way, you don't have to be a specific size or have a certain amount of pace or anything to play the game, just for the sake of it. So, I mean, I really don't like that when I see that, because I think we are losing hundreds of kids who could be playing and not playing because some coaches told them, you're too small, or you're too big, or you're too fat, or you're too this, or you're too that. That's the biggest frustration.
Steve, and again, we're here with Stephen Constantine of the Indian national team. And again, like what you're mentioning about all the different cultural aspects and how they see winning.
It's
interesting that, you know, seeing your resume, seeing you've been to Nepal, seeing you've been to Malawi, from Malawi to Millwall, it could have also been a good title for your book, right? At some point or another. But
Sudan.
Sudan. I'm Rwanda as well, obviously now with India. How is that for you? Because I think that's been a very culturally enriching type of situation where you've been able to bring in your ideas, your way of seeing football. I mean, how has that been, both from a coaching perspective and also, more importantly, from a cultural perspective for you and even your family? I'm not sure if you traveled with them to certain areas or not.
Thanks for rewording the question again, because I don't think I answered your question properly the first time.
Actually, you did. But I mean, I just wanted to spin in a certain way where we can look more at the cultural aspect, because obviously very important for you as a coach is to be able to understand the idiosyncrasies of a particular country. It's not just saying, okay, here's my ideas, you adapt to me as well.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I will say that my wife calls me a chameleon. and there is a reason for that. I would change the color of my skin if it meant that I would get my players to play better or to help them develop. I have a certain amount of knowledge that I have gained over the years from all walks of life and all my career. I started my coaching career in the U.S. My first job as a coach was in the U.S. I got my first qualification in the U.S. I have evolved from there, and I think that no matter where I go, I am the one who has to change. Not the people in Malawi, not the people in Sudan, not the people in Jacksonville or wherever you happen to be. I have to change to suit them. But I have to get the players to play a certain way in order to develop them and improve them, in my opinion. So the first thing you need to do is to understand that, okay, I'm going to the Sudan. What happens in the Sudan? I fasted. They are Muslim in Sudan. I fasted with them. I went to Malawi. I walked the streets. I ate everything that they ate. Why? Because this is what they live. Every day they live this way. So I can bring my knowledge as a coach and my experience and help them on the pitch. But development is not just about what you do on the pitch. A great deal of development is about what happens off the pitch, in the classroom, in the lectures, in the team meetings, at dinner. I would in Nepal, they eat with their hands. Okay, I ate with my hands.
Yeah, you're not eating.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're not eating in a 5-star restaurant inside a hotel that's a little bit more exclusive, a bit of a bubble, if you will. And then try and tell them, hey, this is what you're supposed to do. I've kind of seen that with certain coaches, that they're, okay, no, you guys are over there. I'm over here because I want to be, you know, within my comfort zone. But they rarely decide to step into another situation.
We had a flight from Rwanda somewhere, and the president was traveling with us, and we got on the flight and we took off, and he came up about 15 minutes later. He said, coach, he said, I've got 2 extra seats in business class. Come and sit in business class. And I said, no, give it to the captain and to that boy. They have never traveled business class. Maybe they never will again. Give it to them. I'm quite happy to be on the team bus. I will stay in the same hotel with the players. I will eat the same food as the players, because I am with them. And they have to understand that I am with them. I don't want to stay in a separate hotel. I want to be around them. I want to make sure that they're okay and they have everything they need. And I want them to see that I am going to do and be as much as I possibly can with them in every aspect. Then the player starts to think, he wants to help us. He's going to treat us with respect. He's going to treat us the right way. And I think it's very important that the coach wants to help the players. And I think we are teachers, and we teach football. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so my feeling is you have to be with the players. You have to respect them. You have to help them, and you have to show them that, yes, I have the knowledge to help you. If you want me to help you, I will help you. You can only help a player if he wants to be helped.
And I like the way you've mentioned it, because just being the tactician, being the guy that says, hey, you run this way, you run that way, you're also looking yourself, and you really embrace the role of being a leader of men. Based on your experiences too.
I don't think there's another way. I mean, as a family man, I have three daughters. I know what happens when the child is sick. That's what I call pressure. So I try to make it my business to understand what's happening with the players. You can't help a player unless he wants to be helped, but you also got to understand where he's coming from. Is he coming from Latin America? Does he have this problem? Can he speak English? Does he have friends? Does he have this? If he's an American lad, you don't know what kind of family upbringing he's had. Is his wife okay? Is she pregnant? Has she had the baby? Did the baby sleep? You know, you have to get into everything. I spend a lot of time with the players. I try to find as much as I possibly can, within reason, on how the players, what makes them tick. You know, you see one player comes in and today he's not looking so good. How do you know if he didn't have a fight with his wife, or his girlfriend left him, or something's happened to him in the family? How do you know if you don't know the player and you don't know what he looks like when he doesn't look good, or he walks into the club and you can see something, body language, it's not correct? I think, you know, my wife has spent a lot of money on buying gifts for players who have had babies in my clubs, you know, but I genuinely care about the welfare of my player. It's not act. I have lots and lots of contact with former players. Why? Because they know I actually care.
And that's translated to major strides in the countries that you've coached, correct? I mean, with India, they've gotten, I think, to one of the highest points in the FIFA rankings. I mean, to use the FIFA ranking as a reference, as it misdirected it sometimes, like, as it can be. I think the same thing happened with Sudan. Please correct me if I'm wrong on this. But I think with Sudan, you also were able to get them at a very high level, or a higher level than they've been to, like, pretty unprecedented heights. I guess it's all of these things coming into, right?
You're right. And I mean, look, I think it's a massive thing to get a national team to improve. Okay, the FIFA rankings. Yeah, there are many variables as to what they. And you've got to play games consistently. Now, if you don't play games consistently, that's going to take you down. But if you are playing, be it consistently or not, and losing, then you're going to go down. What does the FIFA rankings actually mean? Is it possible that there are teams, let's say Mozambique, for example, that are below India? Well, if they haven't played and they haven't won, then yes. Does that mean that we are the 96th best team in the world? Look, it is an indication. Nothing more. But as a national association, either you're going to win the World Cup or qualify for the World Cup. We're not going to be there at that moment. Either you're going to win the Asian Cup or qualify for the Asian Cup. We are a breath away from qualifying for the World Cup. Or your FIFA rankings, you're going up. Now, if you go up, that will also increase your level in terms of participating in tournaments.
So, Stephen, you've had a very colorful career and everything, but tell me, and I know this question is going to sound a little bit just broad, if you will, what's been your most rewarding stop as a coach? I mean, you've had plenty of them, but you know, you've had everything from you've mentioned sitting down and breaking bread with your team and eating with your hands, and the great experiences that you've had as a coach, and you've even had kings give you medals. But overall, there has to be a couple of experiences that have stood out above the rest. I mean, have you had any of those types of experiences?
Yeah, God. I mean, there's honestly one. There's so many. I mean, there's one where we beat Congo to qualify for the African Cup of Nations, the group stages, and being tossed around like a rag doll in the stadium when the people invaded the pitch was unbelievable. I just hope they didn't drop me, but they did it, thankfully. And then we got onto the, I can't call it a team bus. It was a minibus that at best would hold about 16. There were about 25 of us crammed into this minibus. And as we set off down the road back to the hotel, the player started to sing this this song. Obviously, it was a Rwandese song, and it made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I mean, just unbelievable. The whole town was... And to be able to give not just the fans but the whole country that feeling that they have done something as a nation, it really is unbelievable. But I think if I come back to down to earth, because those moments are super special, is giving an international debut or a young player his first professional experience, his first game, if you like, that stays with that boy for the rest of his life. And I think to be able to be part of that player's memory for as long as he lives is that is something unbelievable also.
You know, those types of things, I mean, from the more, I mean, for lack of a better term, minuscule, quote unquote, to something, you know, like singing a song in that bus. I could visualize it right now, just rocking back and forth while they're, you know, singing and jumping up and down in there. I mean, for you as a coach, I mean, it's been one of those rides that has had its ups, has had its downs, but mostly it's most of a career where you've been more, you haven't been able to be a prophet in your own land either. I mean, you talk about wanting to, you started as a coach here in the United States, but you've also had a couple of stints in England as well. Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, and of course, not the most, as far as experiences were, they were some that maybe one would consider from the outside perspective as unjust. How is it seen from a coaching perspective to go back to your own country and then not be able to establish a career there? But at the same time, you have a rewarding one abroad.
Well, you know, it's changing in that more and more people are starting to realize what I have done abroad. And they're starting to think, well, if he's done that on foreign soil, maybe he could do something like that for us here. Now, where is here? That's a good question. I really don't mind where I end up or where my next job is, provided that it gives me the opportunity to do what I do. Going from and the reason for the name, by the way, from Delhi to the Den, mm-hmm. is because I was in India in 2002 to 2005, and I left Delhi, or the capital, if you like, and I moved to Millwall, the Den. And it was Owen Amos, the guy who co-wrote the book with me, who came up with that. I walked in from being the national team manager in India to where I would walk in the room and players would stand up, "Hello, sir, how are you?" to going to Millwall, and it was like, "Who are you?" And that was a huge culture shock for me, and I'm English.
It's like going in and having to prove your worth.
Yeah. Well, look, I personally believe that anywhere I go, I have to prove my worth, whereas whether it's in India or in England or the United States. Mm-hmm. you got to do a job. You got to convince the players that you're there to help them, and obviously you got to get the results that you need to keep you in the job. But yeah, it was strange, you know, walking in, and I had a few 17, 18 year olds that were in around the first team squad at Millwall at that time, and they're like, "So what do you do here?" Well, actually, I'm the first team coach, by the way. I've just been appointed. Oh, right. Fair enough. And that would be it. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
that's got to be an interesting conversation to be a part of, as brief as it may be.
Yeah, I of course I took the expletives out of it, but you know, it's like anything else. I think your previous job gets you the job, but in order to keep that job, you've got to be able to prove that you have the quality to do that.
In a way, to me, it seems kind of funny, because that seems to be the case with a lot of English coaches in England. And I'm not talking about the more, I guess, well-established, you know, if you start looking at, you know, at the Steve Bruce's and, you know, the Harry, if you start looking at Harry Redknapp, those type of coaches that have been around for decades. But I'm talking about, you know, more of the newer quote unquote type of player of coaches coming in, and they don't get the chances because the Premier League, and even to an extent the Championship and even League One, you start to see a lot of foreign coaches, and that kind of is limited, just like it's limiting the amount of young players of, you know, in England to play at the highest levels. I mean, do you see that as well? Do you see that trend with coaches? And obviously, because some of the more high-profile coaches, the Mourinhos, Guardiolas, Contes, Pochettinos, all those types of coaches are all foreign.
Well, I think you're right, but the last English manager to win the Premier League, or the first division as it was back then, was Howard Wilkinson. Why are English managers not getting the chance? Well, if you look at the game, how many English managers are coaching abroad? Now, I think there are plenty of good English managers. Eddie Howe, for example, has done a fantastic job at Bournemouth. The lad Sean Dyche at Burnley, unbelievable. There are English managers, but they're not getting the opportunities to coach the big clubs because it's, shall we say, fashion maybe to bring in a Pep Guardiola. Now, had he been English, do you think he would have still been in the job 6 months into the season? I don't know. The slight advantage I give to some of the foreign managers, of course, is that they have very, very good connections abroad in various countries, where I think in England we're a bit insular in some cases. So that might be part of it. But I do think that there is quality in England, especially in terms of dealing with players and how to handle players. But the other thing that I do say is that of the English managers that have gone abroad, what is usually the first thing they say when they come back, having been abroad? I learned so much. I didn't realize that they did this, and this is how it was an education. And I think more English managers need to go out and coach in Germany and Spain and Italy and see how the other half live and how the other half work, because it's quite different in a lot of cases to how things are done in England. But I think that it could be a little bit unfair that the big English clubs are not giving opportunities to English managers. But this is from somebody who can't get a League One club.
I mean, it's funny, you know, some English coaches don't have a chance, but yet a couple of years ago, it was Paul Clement, the assistant coach of Carlo Ancelotti, while he was over at Real Madrid. And to me, it's also a humbling experience, not just a learning experience. I mean, I guess the best case in point would have been to point in the direction of Phil Neville when he went over to coach over at Valencia. And boy, that experience wasn't a very good one for him, because it was more of the club having to adapt to him instead of kind of having to meet halfway as well.
Well, that's what I say when I spoke earlier about it's you that has to change. Now I don't know the circumstances that yeah, Gary went, but that was his first job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
And I think that may have been a bit too early for him. I mean, he has tremendous knowledge of the game. I mean, he knows he was with the England team for some time. But, you know, when you are a coach, you don't call the shots. You don't decide too much in terms of policy. Your job is to get the training sessions out, try and keep the players happy, and you don't get to decide. So it's quite different to being being the manager or the boss, if you like. I don't think Gary's going to be managing anytime soon.
Sometimes the commentary booth or the analyst studio, it gets a little bit comfortable. Trust me. And thanks for correcting me on the Neville brother there that I got mixed up. But you know, I kind of get confused on those two. But it's interesting. I'm going to jump back a little bit to what you said a little while ago here, Steve. You know, about Guardiola, Ancelotti, Guardiola, Mourinho, if they were English. But not just only if they're English. I mean, if they had to deal with the resources or lack thereof resources of many other coaches, would they be at the same level, or would they be willing to take some of these jobs as well?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, obviously, I've had to deal with quite a lot of issues in my time. Fortunately, spending 10 million or 12 million was not one of them. But I think they are, you talk about those three coaches, they are three of the top coaches, managers, man management people going at the moment. Do they need to come down to this level where you have all those problems? I mean, the problems they have are vastly different. How do you deal with the player who's making 100 grand a week? How do you motivate those players? So they have problems, believe me. It's just different, a different level in terms of how do you get those guys to play or motivate them and so on and so forth. So, look, I'm sure any manager worth his salt is by nature a problem solver and somebody who finds solutions and has to adapt and be flexible enough to make sure that he is in the position long enough to lead and to get his point across. So I'm sure they would be fine, but would they want to? That's another story.
Steven, as a coach, who was your main influence? Who was that person that you kind of emulated or really made yourself to really take on a lot of footballing concepts? Or was it a whole smorgasbord of coaching concepts that you were able to gather from different people that made you from a coaching standpoint?
Look, I think that you can't ever copy anybody else and be the same as anybody else. There's a little excerpt from the book I'll just quickly tell you, is that when I was in Cyprus coaching the reserves of Apollon, I was able to go and watch European clubs train before their European games in Cyprus. And one of those teams was Inter Milan. And I went to watch them train one day. I went to watch them before they were playing Apollon in a UEFA game, and I went about an hour early so I could watch the warm up, and I thought it was fantastic. It lasted exactly 30 minutes. 3 days later, I did exactly the same warm up with my under 22 team, reserve team that I was coaching at the time, and we lost 4-0. And after the game. After the game, one of the senior players, because we would take some players that were over 23 and play them because they needed games for the senior team. And one of the guys said to me, Steve, he said, did you go to the Inter Milan game? I said, yeah. How good was that? I think we lost 1-0 for the senior team, which was a good result. He said, yeah. He said, did you see the warm-up? I said, yeah, how it was brilliant. He goes, yeah, it was brilliant for Inter Milan, but it wasn't brilliant for us. That's the warm-up you gave us. So I said, yeah, yeah, I thought it was good. He said, we were exhausted. We couldn't run after 20 minutes in the game. Hence we got a good thrashing. And I learned that lesson that, yeah, I did copy Inter Milan's training session. But guess what? I didn't have Inter Milan's players.
To get a little context, though, I mean, which Inter Milan side was that? Was that the one with Mourinho? Because it was more about the time that
This was in the night. This was Bergkamp and those guys.
Okay.
Where they actually won it that year, by the way.
Okay.
He was saying to me that Osvaldo Bagnoli was the coach at the time. It was 93.
Okay.
And he said to me, "Coach, it was brilliant, but it was Inter Milan." And then, as I said, I learned that day that I can go and watch Sir Alex, I can go and watch Bob Bradley, I can go and watch anybody I want. But if I don't have the quality of players, if I don't know why he's doing this particular warm-up, what is his thought process, how is that going to transform into the game, then you have to think about the level of your players. Mm-hmm. Can they get it? Do they understand it? Is it okay? Is it not okay? And that was a big lesson for me. So to answer your question, I try and take from all the coaching courses I go to and all the sessions that I get to see, and I've seen some great sessions over the years, but I have to make sure that they are tailored to my needs, my players, and my philosophy. So in short, you can never copy anybody else, because a training session that Pochettino will do, I can do exactly the same session, but it will be completely different, because it will be my personality, my delivery, my wording, my body language. You just cannot replicate. So it's better not to copy anybody and just be yourself.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, especially you were, I mean, you're trying to emulate a team that had Walter Senga, Giuseppe Bergomi. I'm trying to remember.
Ruben Sosa.
What's the name of the guy in the midfield, central midfielder? Wijnjonk.
Wijnjonk. Bergkamp was there.
Yeah. But that was in the early stages of your coaching career, if you will. Those are the types of things that you end up, you know, say, oh, well, you know, if they do it, why shouldn't I, you know, that type
absolutely.
Of thing. Right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's part of the learning process, if you will. Let's talk about your book. I know you have to go. I don't want to really consume more of your time, and I really appreciate it. Tell me a little bit about what got you to write your book, or who got you to write your book as well?
Well, look, I've been doing this for quite some time in traveling and working and what have you. About 8 or 9 years ago, I got a random email from a guy called Owen Amos, mm-hmm. who was actually wanted to go to Nepal with his pub team. And he emailed me saying, did I know any teams that wanted a game? I'm the national coach of Nepal, and I've replied to this random guy who wants me to try and help him get a game for his pub team. But I reply to all my emails. I just basically feel if you have the time to write, I have the time to reply. It might not be what you want, but I will reply to you to all my emails. And he got in touch and said, you know, we became friends. And, you know, after a few years, he said, Steve, I think there's a book there. And I'm like, Owen, who is going to read the book? Who has ever heard of Stephen Constantine besides you and me and the people in Nepal? No, he said, you'd be surprised. You've done a lot. And I'm like, yeah, but no one cares because it's not in the US or in England or in Germany. And so, no, he said, let me try. So about 6 years ago, he said, I'm going to write a couple of chapters and we'll see what happens. So he wrote a couple of chapters, couldn't find a publisher. No one was interested. And about 3 years ago, he said, I found somebody. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Found what? He goes, a publisher. I said, a publisher for what? He said, your book. He said, I said, what book? He said, we wrote those three chapters 3 years ago. And I said, really? Are you kidding me? He said, no, they want to see it. No, knock yourself out. And that was it. About 6 months later, he calls me up. He says, great news. What, Owen? He says, they want to publish it. And I'm like, you're kidding me. And he said, no, they like what we did. We've got to do this, 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 and this, and we need to do it by this and this and then. But they're interested. And I have to thank the publishers, the Corbetton Books from Liverpool, who actually put their money where their mouth is, so to speak. And the book was released on the 25th of July. And I hope everybody who reads it enjoys it.
Oh, man, I can't wait because I'm already waiting for my copy, and I'm really anxious to delve into it and the experiences that have been that you're talking about. I mean, just I don't want to really spoil the book so people can really get into it, delve into it, because it really has some very entertaining, very juicy information and great stuff that you've been able to experience throughout your life. My last question, Steve, how have you been able to handle having a family with all this? I mean, have they traveled with you in several cases? Have they not in several others? I mean, because
the basic story is that my wife is a saint.
I think your wife should be canonized by now, especially with the place. I mean, to be quite honest with you, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, with a wife and three daughters, I don't think the most ideal places for you to go to would be places like Sudan, like Rwanda. I mean, it's not where you, hey, why not? Let's just move over there and relocate. I mean, it's not, you know, so how do you deal with those situations?
Well, it's obviously very difficult. But look, in the beginning, we went to Nepal. And the short version is we went to Nepal with one daughter. My daughter was about 14, 15 months when we went. We left Nepal with two daughters. We then went to India with two daughters and we left with three daughters. I got the job in Malawi and she says to me, you're on your own because I'm not coming back with four daughters. So we decided at that point the girls were 9, 10, 5 and a couple of years old that when we got the job in Malawi that the girls would base ourselves in one place so that it was less of an uproot for the girls and school and education and they need that stability. So since the Malawi job, they have stayed in one place. I have obviously, and that place is Cyprus, where we are currently based. Geographically, it's very good for us. Asia is across the pond. Asia is also across the pond, and it's part of the EU. So it's only 3 or 4 hours, depending on where you're going, flight-wise. Actually, 7 from India, but. It's very difficult. I mean, I've left her with boxes to unpack and three girls by herself. I don't know how she's done it, to be honest. She's my best signing.
Yeah, and on top of that, she's not only that, she's the one that buys the gifts for your team, for your players. I mean,
yes, she does.
You know, I mean, you got yourself, man. She's quite the catch.
Don't tell her that she's going to want to renew her contract.
Oh, yeah. She's going to start asking for, I mean, forget Neymar. She's the one that deserves the money. I mean, come on, give me a break. But I mean, I can only imagine, I mean, with three daughters and you going in certain places, you know, for them, it's also a sense of worry. I mean, let's not kid ourselves that there's been certain issues in certain countries that you've been in that you're kind of not necessarily in the crosshairs, but you're somewhere around there.
Yeah. Look, I think you try not to think about those things.
Yeah, of course.
I don't like to call them every day. I know that sounds bad because it's too painful. If you know what I mean, I just want to know that they're okay and we talk and we get by. But it's really tough. I mean, she has enough to worry about with the girls than worry about me. And I don't tell her everything when I'm out anyway, because I don't want to worry her more than she's already worried about looking after the house and the girls' school, activities that the kids have, and homework and cooking and cleaning and the whole thing. I mean, this book, my career is not possible without her, you know, and that's clear as day. I don't have this career without somebody like Lucy.
Yeah, man, and congratulations to you on that, because that's very vital for not just you, but coaches in general. I mean, the wives have to make some tremendous sacrifices to make it happen.
They really do. She has never ever said to me, "No, don't do it, don't go."
Yeah,
she is. If you think this is gonna help your career, and my career doing well in turn helps the family, then we'll do it, and we will all do it.
And I think it's phenomenal. I mean, I think it's phenomenal. I hope, and I can only wish the best for you and for them as well. Final question: of all the players, of all the places where you've coached, who's been the best player that you've had under your tutelage?
Wow. Wow, that is I don't know if I could actually signal out one particular player. There have been some wonderful players. Carlos Garcia from Uruguay mm-hmm. played for me in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Diego Leon from Spain, another one in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. I have Sunil Chhetri in India, who has scored 54 goals in 97, 98 appearances. And I think he's fourth in the world for national team appearances and goals. My assistant coach, Venkatesh, Baichung Bhutia, the captain of India when I was there the first time. Haisam Mustafa from the Sudan, what a player. There's been some Haruna from Rwanda mm-hmm. was brilliant. I mean, there's so many players it would be an injustice for me to say he was brilliant and you know they were all brilliant for me at various moments. Do you know what I mean? It would be unreal for me to say this mm-hmm. guy, that guy. I mean, I've had players who at 16 years old have gone on and played in Greece at professional level, played for the national team. I mean, you know, it's just it's crazy. Difficult question. I need about six years to finish that one.
yeah. I mean, that's usually the case when you have to deal with so many players. But there's one that you mentioned, Sunil Chhetri, of course, the big star for the Indian national team. How you know, and I follow him a lot on different social media outlets, and the impact that he's had within Indian football. Of course, you know, with the Super League, you mentioned some of the players, and one of the players that I follow was Diego Forlan while he was in India. The impact that a player like Chhetri's had, and his ability to be able to do what he's done on the pitch, but also the impact that he's had off of it. Where do you see that as far as the future of football in India? And obviously it's not going to rival cricket, but you're going to have an even bigger base.
It is.
Oh really?
It absolutely is going to rival cricket. I'm telling you, watch this space. Mm-hmm. There is no turning back for Indian football. They host the Under 17 World Cup in October.
Yeah.
The Indian Super League, as I said, is now entering its fourth year. It's not going away. The interest for football is snowballing. The rise of the national team has been phenomenal, and that's down to a lot of variables. Of course, me and my staff and the work that the players have done, the association in allowing me to do what I do. My secretary, she is an absolute machine in the office. Everybody that's connected with the national team have to pat themselves on the back. This is not a one-man band. This is not just me. I am at the helm, if you like, and I make the decisions, but I can't do this by myself. Indian football is not going away. It has started on a snowballing, it started to come down the hill. And it will take some time, but I'm telling you that football now is growing very, very fast in India, and that's great. Now, you mentioned Chetri. Chetri, his impact on India football has been huge. He is somebody who leads by example. He puts his money where his mouth is. He's paid to score goals, and he scores them. And I think he is one player who could have had a bigger career had he gone outside and stayed outside. He had a couple of opportunities, one in the US, he had spent a little time in Portugal. But the thing is that he's Indian, and it's great for players coming up to see that an Indian is actually the highest scorer in the league, or he's scoring these wonder goals for the national team. Obviously it's going to have an impact. And I hope he has a couple more years left in him.
I hope he does too. I've seen some of the goals that he scored in some of the World Cup qualifiers and friendlies, he's a pretty impressive player, and I look forward to seeing him in the future. Steve,
he's a good character as well.
Steve, thank you so much for being on the show. I could talk to you for like 7, 8, 10 hours. And I know I say that a lot to some guests, but with you, I mean, the stories you have to tell and the things that you have to share as far as your football knowledge, I mean, you could probably sit here for hours and on end and be able to talk about football. And that's what we want to hear more about on this show. Where can we follow, or where can some of the fans of the show, people that are listening, follow you and ask you questions and really try to pick your brain?
Well, I think the best way would be on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I have my Twitter account is Stephen Constan. I have Facebook. I have a page on Facebook, which is Stephen Constantine. I think those two avenues are the best. I mean, I would try to answer people as much as I possibly can. Those are the best. Read the book.
Oh, absolutely. I will. Buy the book. again, ladies and gentlemen, Stephen Constantine joining us. Thank you so much, Stephen. It's been a pleasure. Hope to talk to you soon. I hope this is not the first and only time. This will probably be the first of many, as I'll have you on, because we really went through an array of topics today. So it's been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And I appreciate your interest. And good luck to everybody. Have a good season. And see you at the far post.